WBEZ's Nonprofit Spotlight is supported by UChicago Medicine, providing expert primary and urgent care with locations throughout Chicagoland. Their walk-in urgent care locations offer a variety of services for adults and kids 7 days a week. No appointment needed. And for the visits that can wait a day or two, flexible hours and online scheduling make it possible to find a primary care provider partner. Learn more at uchicagomedicine.org. WBEZ is supported by Impact Grants Chicago. Over 400 women come together in a unique model of collective giving. Each member contributes $1,000, and together those donations grow into $100,000 grants for Chicago nonprofits that address critical challenges across the city. By pooling resources, individual gifts multiply into greater impact. Listeners can learn more about Impact Grants Chicago and past grant recipients at impactgrantschicago.org/join2025.
I'm Sasha Ann Simons, and this is Reset. Roxane Gay is a force to be reckoned with. The writer and cultural critic has penned popular feminist literature and is perhaps best known as a highly influential modern voice on the subject. Her books Bad Feminist, Hunger, and Not That Bad explore the contradictions, complexities, and personal stakes of gender, power, and culture with critique and empathy. Her latest project, The Portable Feminist Reader, is a curated collection that explores the multicultural landscape of feminist thought. In it, Gay pulls together some of the best essays ever written on feminism. Now, I recently sat down with Roxane Gay in front of hundreds in the audience for a WBEZ event at the Athenaeum Center in Lakeview. And I started by checking on how she feels about the current moment as well as recent definitions of the word feminism. Here's our full, unedited conversation. And a warning, it contains strong language that may be offensive to some listeners. Good evening, everyone. What a tremendous honor it is to be here with you, Roxane.
Thank you.
Welcome back
to
Chicago.
Oh, thank you. I love Chicago, so it's great to be here.
And Chicago loves you back.
I feel the love, and it's also not snowing, so.
We did that for you.
Yay, Mother Nature and Beyonce. We praise her.
On a scale of 1 to 100... how exhausted are you?
Oh, wait, is one not exhausted? Okay.
Correct.
111.
How exhausted are you from having to explain the meaning of feminism?
159.
When at the same time, all around us, we're seeing examples of people trying to take away women's rights.
You know, that's what's interesting about the question. And I know that most of the time when I'm asked, what is a feminist, what is feminism, people are trying to catch their audience up, or they're asking because there are multiple definitions out there. It's generally in good faith, but it's also 2025. And when you see it, the ways in which the current regime is trying to dismantle women's rights and our access to public life, they know what feminism is, because they're trying to undo its work systematically. So there's a disingenuous nature to the question oftentimes. It's kind of the tongue-in-cheek, ha-ha, what is feminism? Well, it's like, motherfucker, it's everything that you do not represent.
I hear that.
I'm out of patience for it.
She's like, bringing the honesty tonight, ladies and gentlemen.
I mean, people know. And when they ask, it's so, oh, it's just so simpering. What is feminism? I'm like, you've never given a woman an orgasm. That's what I know.
And so you've curated yet another anthology on this very topic.
I did.
Wow.
I did.
Why?
Well, I started this project in 2018, and my editor, Elda Roeder, who's incredible, approached me and asked if I wanted to edit this. The previous version was called The Essential Feminist Reader. And it's rare that black women get to curate these kinds of anthologies. oftentimes we are included in them in the section at the back, like other feminisms. And I just couldn't say no, because I do think it's incredibly important for truly diverse people to be able to shape what we consider feminist discourse. And this is just one entrant. It is not meant to be static. It's not meant to be all-encompassing. But it is an interpretation of feminism and feminist thought. And I really appreciated the opportunity, and I had a lot of editorial freedom to include the works that I did.
Oh, that's exciting.
Yeah.
Editorial freedom. We don't always get that.
No, we don't. The real challenge was budgetary. Anyone who's put together an anthology knows that they're incredibly expensive. And it's not me. I did this for, I'm not even going to tell you how much, but like I said, 2018. But the original permissions budget was $10,000. And if you work in permissions, you know that's like two pieces.
Mm.
And so a few years later, when I finally got around to starting to work on it, my agent went back to Penguin and just said, like, we can't do this for $10,000. And to their credit, they came up off the pocketbook. And I was able to finally put it together the way I wanted. Mm-hmm. And the way I wanted was to include a lot of contemporary work. Because also in these anthologies, you see a lot of ancient texts. And the reason for that is not because people love ancient texts. It's because they're free. The sausage, man, you don't, sometimes you don't want to know how it's made.
So that's the secret.
That's the secret.
Okay.
And so I wanted to have more work from people who are still alive.
This is a good time, though. We are at a very precarious moment when the Trump administration wants to erase words like feminism, like woman, from federal documents. Mm-hmm. They want to roll back a lot of the progress that's been made on some reproductive rights and LGBTQ plus protections. What do you think about that? Why do we need this reader now? She's like, where do I start?
I mean, where do I start? There are so many reasons why I think we need this reader, but I think for a lot of us who haven't been formally trained in feminist discourse and feminist theory, we have no idea where to start.
Yeah.
And the internet can be useful, but Google ruined itself, and so it's not that great anymore for searches. And so a lot of times people stumble around, and thanks to the incredible work of librarians, for example, you can learn things. But it's also nice to have a portable reader, and it is portable. It's very lightweight, and it will fit in your satchel or pocketbook, perhaps. So it was great to be able to do that, just to make this kind of scholarship accessible and to introduce people to the range of what can be considered feminist scholarship, and to be very expansive with that range instead of being so rigid and academic. But now we are in a fucked up time. I'm sorry, I don't have like the fancy words about it. Sometimes you just have to call a thing a thing. And it's incredibly alarming to see how much ground we're losing every single day. And what the current administration is doing is they're testing. They're like velociraptors. And they're testing the fence. If you've seen Jurassic Park, like they're looking for the weaknesses in the fence. And what they're looking for is, what's the limit? How much dirty shit can I get away with before someone finally stops me? And what they're being told by the Democrats is that you can do whatever you want. We'll go get a drink afterwards and talk about it. So we have to do that work that our leaders are incapable of doing and are unwilling, you know, the work they're unwilling to do. And part of that work means that we will not be erased. We will not allow our incredible contributions to humanity to be ignored. You can delete information about us off your funky-ass, ugly websites. But you're not going to delete the actual people. I'm sorry, but that government websites are jankety.
You are speaking facts, my lady.
They're bad.
Facts.
They're ugly as hell. So, like, in some ways, do we really want to be on those websites?
So then what's the role that literature and essays play in shaping feminist thought over activism and policy making?
I don't think it's over. I think it's and. Mm-hmm. These are things that accompany activism and other forms of resistance and ways of creating change and leadership too. Nothing exists in a vacuum, and certainly feminist thought doesn't exist in a vacuum. But what this is a record of who we are, where we've been, how far we've come, and we have come far, despite the ground that we're losing. And the earliest pieces in here are from the 1500s. And back then it was like, oh my goodness, women can do things other than have babies. Wow. My wife is interesting.
Groundbreaking.
Who knew? When she's vertical, she has some interesting things to do. And it's so interesting to see how, like, wide-eyed with wonder men in the 15th or like the 16th century were, like, golly gee. And it's just like, listen, herb. get thee a mirror. But it's just interesting to see, like, we were starting with women are sentient, and that's progress that we have moved slightly beyond that.
Slightly.
I mean, slightly, because when you look at what's happening, it's incredibly alarming. The way they're going after no-fault divorce is pathetic, because if you can't make your wife or encourage your wife to stay married to you without forcing her, then perhaps you should do some reflection about why you're so fucking repulsive that she needs to get away from you. But, I mean, who am I to judge?
We listen, but, and we don't, you know, judge.
We have to be aware of these things, and we have to talk about them. Anyone who's read Project 2025, like, it's grim. If you really get into, like, page 900... you know, toward the end, the section on women, they want to remove our right to access credit, mm-hmm. which, on the one hand, okay. But really, that's horrifying. They really are trying to send us back. They're trying to remove us from the workplace. They are trying to remove all of the advances that we've made personally and professionally. And a lot of the white women who have voted for Trump because they want proximity to power are about to find out.
Oh, yeah. Oops. So you talk all through the text about how, you know, feminism has evolved significantly over the decades. It shows in the text. Mm-hmm. You acknowledge it first in the intro of the book. And you reminded me of L.A. Law.
Yeah.
I forgot about that show, Roxanne.
Yes. So during the pandemic, my wife and I started watching, during the height of the pandemic, I should say, we started watching Columbo, and highly recommend.
Classic.
We watched every single episode ever made. Like, we also watched Mrs. Columbo. Short-lived and very good. And what was interesting was the kinds of stuff they put on television back then, the misogyny and sort of gentle racism, not so gentle. It's like, wow. And they weren't being mean. They were just like, it's Tuesday. Mm-hmm. And it was very interesting. And then we started to watch L.A. Law, which was a show in the 80s and 90s, late yeah. 80s, early 90s. And the misogyny was, frankly, even worse in L.A. Law. There's this guy, Michael, who keeps trying to woo Susan Day's character. And he's basically stalking her. She's mm-hmm. engaged to another man. And he persists and persists and persists. And we're supposed to see this as, like, this incredibly romantic pursuit when it's actually just a crime.
Didn't he, like, creepily meet up with her husband?
He did. He, under the pretext of some law nonsense, he met with her fiancé but didn't tell her fiancé that he was having an affair with her, which I guess is good. But, I mean, just truly not good stuff. And so when you see these cultural artifacts reflecting what we considered to be standard at the time, it is useful.
Yeah.
And so I write about that in the beginning of the introduction. as one of the ways of showing that we have actually made progress. We do have better standards now for how we think about women in the public sphere, how we treat women.
Yeah. The examples you say, you know, they come from the 1500s to the present. So mm-hmm. was there a balance that you were trying to strike, trying to ensure that the anthology covers enough historical perspective and then also enough modern interpretations of feminism?
I was less concerned with chronology than I was with theme, because the reality is that this is by far not the only feminist reader. And many of those readers do cover early feminist thought quite well. There are entire anthologies, in fact, devoted.
Right.
So I didn't feel the need to reinvent the wheel. And so I do include some pieces from ye olde times as a foundational thing so that we can better appreciate how contemporary scholars have built on that foundation. And so that's what I was really looking at, more than trying to cover each century, for example, adequately. It wasn't going to be possible. And I'm actually surprised they let me put in as many pieces as I did, because yeah. it's like 700 pages long.
Yeah, it's jam-packed.
It is.
I've been reading the book since January.
You know, a little cozy book to, you know, curl up with.
They're like, Roxanne's coming in a couple months. I'm like, send me that book. I looked up how many pages there were. I was like, send
the book
now. I know.
When I saw it on the bookshop.org and I was looking up the, I don't know why I was looking up the page count when I had the PDF, but I was. And it just felt easier. And I looked up the page count and I was like, wow.
I did that?
Who knew? That is a lot of words.
As was alluded to earlier, we can remember, or folks who read Bad Feminist remember how honest and open you were about your own flaws. Yes, of course. Give it up. You know, you said that at the time there were many ways in which you were doing feminism wrong, mm-hmm. right? And you were open about that. Still, though, admitting that you are deeply committed to the issues, the important feminist issues. But you like the Yin Yang Twins, and you like their music, and you like to drive and listen to some ratchet hip hop, and
I mean,
you know,
we all have a little ratchet in us.
We do.
And I think it's important to nurture that.
So on that note, I mean, was it ever, was the goal ever to try to minimize some of that, some of those contradictions, or was it more of an, I am who I am?
It was mostly I am who I am, but also a way of creating space within feminism for all of us, because oftentimes feminist discourse can seem kind of exclusionary. That you have to have perfect politics or else.
Yeah.
And that leaves a lot of people out. And I don't think it's particularly productive when we really do need all hands on deck for the kinds of fights that we're trying to engage in as feminists. And so it was about creating space and then holding that space. And I'm often asked, would you change anything? Have your opinions changed? Like, no. I still think the same things. But I would also say that in the ensuing decade, since it was first published, I've started to think more about accountability. Mm. Because a lot of people misunderstood the Bad Feminist thing a bit and took it to mean like it was a permission slip, that I can do any funky old thing, but I'm still a feminist. Mm. And no, like, no, ma'am. A lot of times women, conservative women, will come up to me and say, I'm pro-life, but I'm a bad feminist. And then I'm just like, and I will say to their faces, no, no, you're not a feminist. Mm-hmm. Feminists are not pro-life. And so I do want to think more about accountability. Thank you.
Yeah.
I do think we have to acknowledge that, yes, we are flawed. Yes, for example, we can like ratchet music, but if we don't take account for that and recognize that there is an impact to the choices that we make.
Absolutely.
There's no incentive for the people making those ratchet ass songs to do better. And so while my opinions, I stand by what I wrote 10 years ago, I do hope that my work now is more mature and does express more of thinking about accountability.
Yeah.
And that there are repercussions for our choices.
So do you think that there is still a narrative or a myth out there that a feminist has to be a certain kind of woman? She hates men,
Oh,
she
yeah.
She has no sense of humor.
Absolutely.
She's militant.
Yes. Amen. No, and you know, what's interesting is that we can gather in a space like this with just so many incredibly intelligent people who care about the world, but then when we leave this building, we are with the rest of the world. And there are lots of good people in the world, but there really are so many people who are still at Feminism 101, who still have these very antiquated ideas of who a feminist is and what she represents. And men are very, I mean, this is a generalization, but cis men tend to be a bit sensitive and very in touch with their feelings. And they always feel like women advocating for equity and a life free from violence and unlegislated bodies is somehow taking something from them. And it's not, actually, Fred. It is...
Who was the guy earlier? Herb?
Herb. Really Herb or Herbert, but yeah. I like to... The H is silent for me.
What's your girlfriend group like? How are you actively working to nurture and preserve your friendships with women?
Yes, I mean... I think all of my friends are, well, my friends are generally women and or non-binary people.
Okay.
And for me, the way that I nurture those friendships, I'm more of a shower than a teller. And so it's about maintaining those bonds, being there for people when they actually really, really need you, like when the bottom falls out and they need someone to catch them. But also like group text.
I was gonna say, what's your text style?
Oh,
are you the lurker? Are you just there? Just like
I am a bit of a lurker. However, you never know when I'm gonna pop up. You never know when I'm gonna put a little something spicy in the group chat. Just to let everyone know, oh, I'm reading all of it. Because I love when my friends share like random gossip about Sue and accounting. I don't know Sue, but I know Sue. And I love it. I just love hearing about their lives. And given that my friends are very dispersed around the world, mostly across the US, but in some other places as well, these ways of connecting are really helpful for maintaining those bonds so that when we see each other, it actually feels like there has been no separation. And I care about their lives, and I know that they care about mine as yeah. well. And many of my friends, we don't have to talk every day, but if you call me and say, I need you to bring a shovel and a bag and a piece of rope, I'll be like, let me run to Home Depot and wait,
you're not
let me
asking
get the,
questions?
Let me get some cash from an ATM first. Let me go to Home Depot. I'll see you in an hour.
No questions asked.
No, never. Like, where are we burying
where
her?
Where are we going?
Or him. Let's go.
You wrote a pretty great essay last year. It was called Stand Your Ground, A Black Feminist's Reckoning with America's Gun Problem.
Yep.
Yes, please. If you got a chance to read it, you know what I'm talking about. It was really good. You got very personal. We learned about your thoughts on gun ownership. We learned about your brother.
Yeah.
And his influence, Joel, right?
Yes.
Buying your own firearm.
Mm-hmm.
And much more. So how does your identity as a black woman shape the way that you experience and interpret America's relationship with guns?
Well, America has a very toxic relationship with guns, and I honestly believe that no one should own guns. It's going to be the end of many of us. And it's always interesting to see that this country is more enamored with gun ownership than preserving human life, and especially the lives of our children. Time and time again, every time, like when Sandy Hook happened, I thought, wealthy white children, that's gonna push this to where it needs to be. And then Uvalde, Texas, the Florida high school, Marjorie High School. There are so many, and it's so many per year.
Mm-hmm.
But my brother Joel was a gun enthusiast. He was a gun nut.
and, you know, a good gun owner and all that. But for years and years, he was trying to get the rest of us in the family to get on board with guns. And I was always like, well, no. And my brother was like, no. And my parents were like, oh, no, we don't need to do that. Oh, no. And toward the end of his life, he died 3 years ago. Toward the end of his life, he was like, okay, now, Rox, you really have to get one. Because he had been reading all of the news articles when COVID began where people were buying guns at alarming rates.
2020.
And, yes. Mm-hmm. And so he finally broke me down. And I was like, okay, fine, I'll go. I'll get a gun. And it was really interesting to me because when I went to the shooting range to take lessons, because I'm that girl who, like, I will study, I will take notes, I will read 5 books, but I want to be competent. I noticed that there were lots of black women there. Now, I live in Inglewood, and it's a predominantly black community. And so, of course, I'm going to predominantly see people of color at this gun range, but it was black women, and they were really competent. They knew what they were doing. They were pulling back their targets, and there was just like one hole. Because
wow.
All of the bullets were going in the same place.
Oh my.
And that's when the essay idea came to me, because I thought, we have a lot of misperceptions, and we have allowed gun ownership to be the purview of white masculinity. But what are other groups doing with regards to gun ownership? And I learned a lot. A lot of black women are arming themselves because I think we understand keenly that no one else is going to protect us.
Yeah.
Oftentimes, when we call the protectors, they kill us. And so I just decided, yes, I'm going to explore this intellectually, but then also, like, yes, do not come to my house and think that it's going to be a tea party. I mean, uninvited.
Unannounced.
You're all welcome
yes.
to my house.
That's what she means.
I mean, like, don't come to try and do a crime and think you're going to get away with it. I have cameras, so if you kill me, they're going to know you did it.
How do you see that burden of gun violence falling differently on black women, especially those who are in like under-resourced communities?
Well, I mean, it falls on us in so many different ways. I think it's our children who are on the front lines of gun violence, who are being mowed down every single day, mm-hmm. and oftentimes our partners,
yeah.
and ourselves even. And nobody really talks that much about that because in general, we tend to minimize the concerns of women, but especially the concerns and the issues that black women face. Look at the maternal mortality rate. So it's important to listen to what, you know, we always hear in pop culture, listen to black women. But no, like actually listen to black women. And you're gonna learn some very interesting things.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the women I interviewed for the piece is a black mother. She has a child at home, but she decided that she wanted to protect herself. And her instructor was actually Griff from Public Enemy. He's a gun instructor now.
Really?
Yes. It's amazing.
Who would have thought?
I know. But I just really found that actually doing some research and trying to really hear what black women were telling me was very useful because it's not just what you read in the news stories. It's not just statistics. These are actual people who are grappling with, I don't want to be a tool of violence. I don't necessarily want a tool of violence in my home, but I also don't want to be defenseless when violence comes to my doorstep.
Mm.
And it's tricky to try and balance all of those things. And it's an ongoing work of just negotiation with the self.
Pivoting back to the portable feminist reader, is there a particular piece in the collection that deeply resonates with you or maybe has changed your thinking?
I mean, and I don't mean this in a cheesy way, they all do. I felt a connection to everything that I included, but I was particularly moved by Tressie McMillan Cottom's In the Name of Beauty. She's extraordinary and one of the smartest people of any gender working and writing and thinking today. So to be able to include a piece of hers was awesome. And the thing about Tressie is that she does not pander. And so she will write about things that really force you to have uncomfortable conversations with yourself.
And her essay collection, Thick, really did that for me. I'm still thinking about Thick, and I return to it quite often. I teach essays from it, and that's why I wanted to include that piece here, because she really made me think about beauty, and that we don't have to strive for that, because we actually live in a world where, as Black women, we're never going to be considered beautiful. And so we can claim other things. We don't have to play by the sort of rules where beauty is dictated by white womanhood, for example. Mm-hmm. And in it, you know, in the conversation that she's having in this essay, it's like, oh, wait, you know, have that reflective response when someone says, oh, I'm not beautiful, where you're like, oh, no, of course. You're... It really forces you to go beyond that. And so that piece has stayed with me for years.
Yeah. Are there pieces in the book that you would say sort of address the generational divide in feminism? Because I, you know, when I think personally about the way my mom and my grandma mm-hmm. think about womanhood versus my two teenage daughters and the things mm-hmm. I hear them say mm-hmm. and what they post on social media, I open my eyes widely because mm-hmm. I'm thinking, wow, things have changed.
They have.
Gen Z is something else.
Listen. Gen Z and then those little Gen Alphas.
Ooh. Don't even get me started with them.
They're scary. I have several Gen Alphas in my life, and I'm terrified of them. I will not cross those girls ever. Just like when they walk by and they're still talking to me, I'm like, yes. I made it through another day. But in terms of generations, there are some second wave pieces
yeah.
because I was very interested in what were our sisters in the 60s and 70s thinking about. And what's interesting is that a lot of those pieces are about the politics of domesticity and housework. I included a piece called I Want a Wife. And yes, you should get one, but not for the reasons that you think. And the way that she was articulating that she wants support, the things that wives tend to provide, and also the politics of housework
yeah.
was another great essay. And what was also just heartbreaking is that similar pieces are being written today about the division of domestic labor and heterosexual relationships. And that is just, it's sad. And that we, you know, I'm Gen X, but like that, those of us who are present day feminists are still having these same concerns is alarming. And so that was the other thing that really came across in terms of generations. It's not that the voices were that different. They were more like peace, love, and happiness. And like, let's all like pass around the talking stick. But the core issues they were concerned with are the core issues we're concerned with today. And that tells us something too.
I kind of feel like I know the answer to this next question, but I'm going to ask anyway.
All right.
How did you mentally prepare for any kind of resistance or pushback to this text or any concepts in the text? And was that even a concern for you?
Well, yes and no. Whenever you talk about feminism publicly, people are going to feel some kind of way. People that you would think you're aligned with and people who hate you.
Yeah.
And sometimes that's the same person. But I hope that this encourages conversation. I hope that people say, here's what I would include in a feminist reader. And how did I prepare? Well, I don't read Goodreads of my own books. I use Goodreads as a reader, but not as a writer. And there are just places that I don't go. Like, I know, and I left Twitter more than a year ago. I don't put myself in places where I have to subject myself to unnecessary nonsense.
Mm-hmm.
Because the people who really want to engage with me in good faith will engage with me in good faith, but those people are not on the internet, per se.
Yeah. I'm going to weave in a few questions that we got from audience members. Thank you so much to those who submitted questions ahead of time for Roxanne. This one's from Fran, who's in our audience tonight. Fran says, do you see the needle moving much if white men don't start stepping up?
That's a good question. Yes, the needle's going to move with or without them. But it's going to move a lot faster if they get on board. But are they going to get on board?
I don't know. And the reason I don't know is because for years we've told ourselves that, oh, the racists and bigots and homophobes, you know, all of those people, they're going to die off. The most recent election showed us, no, they actually just raised a whole new generation of bigots and people who feel entitled to companionship, who feel entitled to wealth, who feel entitled to women's bodies, who feel entitled in general, and who are angry that they aren't able to live the way their grandfathers lived, where they could like buy a house and raise two or three kids and have two cars and two vacations a year on $30,000 and a high school degree. And I mean, I wish that was the case for everyone. I wish everyone could live the life they wanted, could be financially comfortable. That's actually what we're fighting for. Mm-hmm. But there are some people that want to hoard it for themselves. And a lot of those people, unfortunately, are white men. They are incredibly threatened by progress. And that's why we're seeing this incredible backlash right now. Even I have to say I'm shocked by the ferocity of the backlash. I am. Mm-hmm. I knew, like, we knew that there was going to be, like, a punishment for Obama, who was a moderate. And, like, if that is who you have a problem with, you are not ready for, like, a less moderate tan suit wearing president.
Well, what surprises you the most? You said you're shocked.
I'm just... The way that the current administration, for example, is just dismantling everything. It's not that I'm naive, but I guess I was naive.
I think a lot of us were.
I just didn't know you could like send some 19 and 20-year-olds into buildings with a hard drive and they could get access to all of our personal information and kick people out of federal buildings, including like the Institute for Peace, which, what on earth are you people doing? Like, there's no sense to it. It's like that movie Pacific Heights, where the guy goes and he rents the apartment and destroys it and then disappears for no reason. Mm-hmm. And that's what we're seeing. They're destroying things because they can. There's no ideology behind it. And so I'm shocked. And I'll get over the shock. I think we all will because we don't have a choice, but it's happening quite quickly and extensively, and it can all be undone, but not forever. Like,
yeah.
We have to mount a response, and it starts with our elected officials, and unfortunately, the gerontocracy is so incompetent. I just don't understand it. And it's all of them. Like, I live in California and New York. And in California, Maxine Waters is one of our congresspeople. She's incredible.
Yeah.
She's brilliant. Why is she still running? Why is Nancy Pelosi running again in 2026?
Yeah. That is a good question.
And why are we okay with this? It's appalling. It's appalling. What more do these people have to prove? Chuck Grassley, I mean, he's being kept alive by like nanobots and some evil Russian, like, I don't know, virus. That man is older than time. How is he still alive? How is he still in the Senate? Look what they did to poor Dianne Feinstein.
Oh,
I mean, rolling that, oh, no. And so we have to deal with the gerontocracy. Even Bernie, bless his heart, full of energy, down with the cause, et cetera. But my good sir, why do these people want to die at work?
But still, you write often about resilience, mm-hmm, and survival. Do you find hope anywhere in the current moment?
No, I sure don't. Here's the thing.
Next question.
The thing about resilience is that we ask so much of marginalized people.
we ask so much of ourselves. We ask so much of people who are otherwise marginalized. I just don't know how much people have left. I just don't. And I think especially of what is happening to the trans community. And the thing about this administration is that they only pick on people they think they can win against. Mm-hmm. They're cowards. And so they're going after a community that is less than 1% of the country. And that is a precious 1%, to be clear. But they're doing it because they think no one is going to stand up and fight. And so far, they have been proven correct. And so how much more resilience are we going to ask of the trans community? How much more resilience are we going to ask of people in Gaza, for example, where the ceasefire has ceased? I just think we have got to stop relying on resilience as the thing, because we have asked too much of far too many people.
It's a good time for another question from the audience. This one comes from Tracy. Tracy recently saw you do another appearance where you called yourself an optimistic pessimist.
Yeah.
And she says, I'm a therapist working in crisis mental health work, and many of us in the field were struggling ourselves with what's happening in the world while helping others. I'm leading a self-care workshop for the team on March 27th, so that's tomorrow. I'd love to hear if you have any advice for us on the front lines of mental health crisis that we're facing as a nation.
Well, first of all, on an airplane, put your mask on first. I think that people in mental health, especially in crisis care, are indeed on the front lines right now and are being burnt out by the amount of care that people are needing to get through what is a really just abominable period in American history. So you have to take care of yourself in whatever ways that looks like. If you deplete all of yourself in service of your work, then the people who need you long-term aren't going to have access to you. But I also really believe in listening to people and not giving them the resilience piece of advice, because sometimes you just need to hear that, yes, things are terrible and I don't know if they're going to get better, and you are correct and justified in feeling what you feel. Sometimes you just need to be affirmed in that. And I hope that we can give people that space to just say, yes, things are pretty terrible right now. But also that you're not alone. I think a lot of people can feel alone. There is a lot of alienation, but some people turn that alienation outward and try to destroy the country. And other people turn that alienation inward and try to destroy themselves. And hopefully there's a third path that doesn't end in destruction for anyone.
What impact do you hope the Portable Feminist Reader will have on readers who may not consider themselves feminists?
Mm-hmm. I just hope that it introduces people who may not have a background in feminism or even an interest. I hope it just introduces them to the brilliance of feminist thought, the range of it, that it's not any one thing, that it's not all academic and full of jargon, that there's Helen Cizou, who's just buck wild, Donna Haraway, also buck wild, amazing. But then there's also a poem from Patricia Lockwood, a poem from Franny Choi, essay from Tressie McMillan Cottom, an essay from Liz Huerta. There's just a lot. And they can also see that feminism is embedded in every aspect of our lives. It mm-hmm. is not just a thing. It's not just about women. It's about everyone. And so hopefully they'll get something from that.
One of my favorites is at the end, you throw in this list of multimedia recommendations, right? Mm-hmm. So you've got TV shows to watch, films, theater, visual art, music.
Yeah.
Walk us through the thinking behind what to put in there. And I want to find that music list because I was loving it.
Well, when I was putting this together, my editor said, hey, also, by the way, when you're done writing all these head notes for these pieces and the introduction and editing everything, would you mind coming up with a list of suggested reading? I was like,
extra work?
Great. But then I thought, it doesn't have to just be reading.
reading is great, and there is suggested reading. Both books and I think a few like just individual essays.
You've got
and
essays
chapters.
In there.
Mm-hmm. But also like music and art, just all of the things that we engage with in our day-to-day lives. And so just some suggestions.
Back to Black, Amy Winehouse.
Yes.
Bad Girls, Donna Summer.
Yes.
Code of Many Colors by Dolly Parton. Control by Janet
yes.
Jackson. Cowboy Carter.
Yes, that whole album. I'm seeing Cowboy Carter on April 28th. I'm taking my nieces.
What city?
Los Angeles.
Okay.
I'm going on opening night with my nieces and their moms, and it's going to be amazing. I'm ready. I have my cowboy hat. It's a Stetson. I got it as a gift
really?
From some promotional thing for some Western TV show, and I'm going to wear the shit out of that hat. I'm just going to be like, giddy the fuck up. Let's go.
I cannot wait to
see. I am from Nebraska.
You're going to post pictures on Instagram, right?
Of course. Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
That is a must.
Oh, no. I take Beyonce very seriously.
And I made sure that you put lemonade.
I did put lemonade.
Very smart.
Yes.
Yeah. But so much here. Jagged Little Pill. I could go on and on. Which leads me to a question we got from Kat in the audience. Kat says, because I so deeply cherish Roxanne's takes on popular culture, my question is, Sabrina Carpenter.
Well, guys, I would love to tell you all about what I think about Sabrina Carpenter, but I'm 50 years old. I know the name. My nieces love her, but I have not yet gotten to her. I just got into Chappelle Roan.
Oh, yes.
So, like, I get to the current stuff when it's not necessarily current anymore. I know the names, but, right now I'm... Pink Pony Club is very good. It's a whole narrative. When you listen to the lyrics, I'm like, oh my God, this is story time. Tell me more. It's so good. I was late to her, but I'm glad I got there.
Well, what do I hear about you and Channing Tatum getting romantic and writing steamy, sexual, hot stories together?
It's torrid. We're writing a romance novel together. Yes. It's also been in the works for several years.
Whose idea was this?
It was his.
Oh. I know that's
right. It's a long story, but a very good one.
We've got all night. Go ahead.
Yeah. Several years ago, he was being interviewed by an Australian journalist who was like, oh, do you know that the feminist writer Roxane Gay has a crush on you? And he was like, no. And she went on to explain, she wrote this book called Bad Feminist. Have you read it? He was like, no, but I'll check it out. And he actually did.
Wow. Accountability.
So then he got an opportunity to do a book. And he thought, I honestly have no idea how he did this. My agent called me and she said, are you sitting down? And I was like, yeah. And then she said, no, really, are you sitting down? And I said, sure. And so I did sit down because she's never said that twice. And she was like, Channing Tatum wants to work with you. And I was just like, what are you talking about? Like, what does he want, a blurb? And one thing led to another. It's been in the works for many years because I had a 5-year period of what I thought was writer's block. But turns out it was just menopause. But now I'm coming out of that brain fog. I mean, girls and others, if you are nearing a certain age, go talk to your crones and we will help you. Because not enough conversations are being had about it's a nightmare. Whatever adolescence was, it's 20 times worse. Mm. And doctors just look at you like, I don't know. I don't know. Is my period ever coming back? Could be, could be not. Are the hot flashes going to kill me? Perhaps. Anyway, now that it's coming out, I'm finally able to sort of revisit the project and finish it. But like, we've been collabing and brainstorming
together. How do I get in on
together.
Those writing sessions?
They're great. They're so good.
Let me bounce this idea off you, Channing.
I mean, I will bounce a couple things off of him.
And on that note, I feel like it's time for...
Bad feminist. I'm so sorry. Thank you so much, everyone, for being here.
Thank you. Roxane Gay, ladies and gentlemen, the Portable Feminist Reader is out now. Thank you all so much. Roxane, thank you.
Thank you. Sasha Ann Simons, everyone.
This episode of the Reset Podcast was produced by me, Sasha Ann Simons. I also mixed the pod with some help from Ari Mejia. Reset brings you breaking news and nuanced conversations. To never miss an episode, hit subscribe wherever you listen or visit us at wbez.org/reset. I'm Sasha Ann Simons. Thanks for listening.
My name is Donald. I live on the southeast side of Chicago. I support WBEZ because of the balanced reporting and covering so much about an issue as opposed to just the few seconds that you may hear on most other news outlets. It matters to me to hear the story more completely